I'm Nadine Smith, Executive Director for Equality Florida, the state's LGBTQ advocacy organization, and I want to thank you all for joining us. When we began to envision this panel weeks ago, George Floyd was alive in Minneapolis. Tony McDade had not been shot by police in Tallahassee. We began the planning in the aftermath of Ahmaud Arbery's killing by white vigilantes just 2 hours over the Florida border. We'd organized an LGBTQ response in the aftermath of Trayvon Martin's murder, and the echoes were unmistakable. We also wanted to draw attention and outrage to the epidemic of Black transgender women being murdered, including 7 transgender women murdered in Florida in less than 2 years. And we wanted to ensure that when people say Black Lives Matter, and they should, that they truly meant all Black Lives Matter. And finally, with Pride Month, we really wanted to reassert June as a commemoration of a street rebellion against hate violence and unchecked police brutality. We wanted to be one of the voices that said enough is enough, that the normalization of police brutality, so normal that the presence of video cameras did not save George Floyd, had to be challenged, and LGBT voices had to be part of challenging it. And finally, we wanted to amplify the voices of the Black LGBTQ experience. We who live in the intersection of identities, with the added danger that racism and anti-LGBTQ hatred puts in our path. And now this conversation comes as people have taken to the streets, where the brutality that is a common occurrence in Black neighborhoods is now on display for the entire nation and the entire world. America is at a crossroads. In the words of demographer James Johnson, we are a country in a demographic convulsion. A nation increasingly of Black and brown people and older white people, and the shifting demographics have created a panic that expresses itself not only in the words and obvious actions of white supremacists, but also in the fear and discomfort and silence of white people who see that shift and wonder what it might mean to be a minority in a country that has not treated minorities well. So it was with that spirit that we began this conversation, that we invited these panelists. And in this context, we think it is critical that the LGBTQ community be vocal and visible, unafraid to say the words white supremacy, unafraid to speak out to end the violence, state-sanctioned and hate-sanctioned, against the Black community, and to remember that this is our fight. We do not show up to it as allies, but we understand that our liberation, that our freedom is tied to ending this system. So with that, I'd like to invite our guests to join us, and we'll be joined later by Minneapolis City Council Vice President Andrea Jenkins. The murder of George Floyd occurred in her ward, and so obviously she's at the center of much of what is happening right now. I'd also like to bring up Alfonso David, who is the president of HRC, Imani Rupert Gordon, the executive director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and Michelle Rayner, who is a civil rights attorney who has been at the forefront when these kinds of vigilante killings, this kind of police brutality occurs. She is one of those civil rights attorneys who gets the phone call. So obviously this is a week that has roiled the nation, and Alfonso, let me turn to you to share your thoughts on where we are, why it's important for us to collectively have issued this statement, and where we go from here.
Thank you, Nadine, for moderating us tonight, for your words of wisdom, for your commitment and your passion to justice and equality. Many people may not know this, but you've been in this movement for a very long time, and a lot of people owe a lot of debt of gratitude to you, and thank you for your leadership of Equality Florida. I also want to just say hi to my fellow panelists tonight. What do I think we're going through right now is an existential crisis in this country where people are hopefully being put in a position where they are seeing beyond themselves. I gave a speech in September of last year when I took over the Human Rights Campaign, and it was a call to action. And I asked people to really think about how they could see beyond themselves. Because if we are going to achieve liberation, if we're going to achieve equality and have that equality be sustainable, we have to see beyond ourselves. We have to care about issues that don't directly affect us. That is how we achieve equality. if we're pushing for policy solutions because they directly affect us. If we only care about legislation because it affects our family members. If we only push for specific initiatives because it affects people that we know or who we know, we will never get to that place where we achieve equality and have it be sustainable. Yes, we win pieces of legislation. Yes, we win cases in courts of law. But we need to get to a place collectively where we can achieve equality. In this past week, where the country has been reeling from the plight of Black people in this country, I am hopeful that this is an opportunity where people can indeed see beyond themselves.
Thank you. Imani, what's your take on where we are and what's happening right now and our role in this?
I'm excited to talk about this subject because the intersection of LGBTQ identity and racial justice is a popular topic this week. It's a popular topic for some of us every week. And the complexities that that come with experiencing discrimination at multiple levels, it's not novel. It's a reality that many of us navigate every day. And though intersectionality has become a buzzword, a catch-all for everything, we don't always do the best job of explaining what that is. To be intersectional isn't the understanding that it's hard when someone has multiple marginalized, underrepresented identities. Intersectionality is looking at the systems in place that were created for everyone to thrive and get to liberation. It's an intersectional fail when someone falls through the cracks or doesn't receive benefits or cannot properly access supports because the systems weren't created for them. And we're at this moment right now where collectively our communities are recognizing this and demanding justice at the same time. And this is what's going to happen when a community is consistently left out of systems that translate to other negative outcomes. And this has happened historically. So, you know, right now it's all too common for us to see Black people killed by the people that have sworn to protect us. And we know that Black transgender people, especially trans women of color, are being murdered with very little investigation going into these murders. And most of them are going unsolved. But not only that, we see trans people being misgendered then after death. And so all of these things is something that we're considering. And so I'm excited to have this conversation now because it's been too long. It's just too much. And something special is happening now. And we've seen something like this before. And so I'm excited to see where our community takes us.
Michelle, you've been at the forefront of these battles, whether it is vigilante murders of Black people or whether it is police brutality. Is this different this time? Is there something else in the air right now that feels like it portends real change?
You know, feels that it's just more. But with that feeling different, I think that we have to be very strategic about the moment that we're in, right? Very strategic about what our actual demands are. We have to be intentional with that. It does feel like you may get across the goal line, wherever that goal line is. But then in my mind, you know, the cautiously optimistic mind, but also someone who does his work, I always know that we think that we're at the goal line and then the goal line gets moved, right? And then we think we're at the goal line and then it gets moved again. So it's kind of, you know, we're always running to catch up. But I think that this conversation is really important because I know that a lot of times in our community get left out. But as I have pointed out and I will continue to say, we're not for queer folks. If it were not for gay, lesbian, transgender folks, we have been at the crux, the foundation of this work, right? And so I think that it's vital to have our voices represented and not just represented to say, oh, representation matters, but at the table, making the decisions, because when other folks said they wanted to stay home, we were out there pushing this work for all Black lives.
Thank you. And, you know, one of the things that we talk about a lot, you know, intersectionality has become something that people say, but it doesn't always get embodied in work. There was a statement that was signed on by now hundreds of LGBT organizations. And basically that message was that the LGBTQ movement writ large has to make this central to the work. Not a side dish, but to understand that rights mean nothing if you don't have the freedom to exercise them. And that Black LGBTQ people are not exempted from all of the obstacles that racism puts in our path. And in fact, we are disproportionately targets of that violence. We are disproportionately pulled into the criminal justice system. And it feels as though this kind of space feels way too rare, where all of us are talking to each other. And that's one of the things I think has to change. So not only do I think we have to reclaim the history of pride, but also Black Lives Matter movement, which was very intentionally built to include all Black lives, to include the LGBTQ experience. Who wants to speak to that?
I talked briefly, I think it may have been yesterday or the day before, all of the days now merge, and I've lost track. But, you know, as people of color, and specifically Black people, and I think this is an important point for people who are not people of color to appreciate. When you're LGBTQ and you're also Black or a person of color, you are forced in many instances to create a hierarchy of identity. And that is an important concept for people to appreciate, the hierarchy of identity. If someone were to ask you, Nadine, or ask me, how do you describe yourself? What do we say first? Gay? Black? Immigrant? Those identities are, of course, all important to me. But our society forces us to create a hierarchy and place certain values on those identities. And it's important as leaders in the LGBTQ space, and it's important as the community writ large to appreciate that all of those identities have to be assigned value. And as Black people and as people of color operating in the LGBTQ space, all too often systems have been created that either force us or indirectly make it difficult for us to recognize our race or ethnicity. And you mentioned the letter that now more than 500 LGBTQ organizations have signed on to, which is an incredibly important and powerful first step to make sure that we say that, yes, we are explicitly standing in the shoes of Black men and women and saying Black Lives Matter. We're also saying that the issue of race and the issue of ethnicity cannot be sort of ancillary to our mission. It has to be core and central to our mission. And so what does that really mean? What that means is how we speak about the work, how we talk about the work, how the work is reflected in press releases, has to be intersectional. And people that are doing the work have to think about, as they do the work, is it being inclusive? Are we talking about places? Are we talking about this work from different perspectives so that it's not just uniform? But marriage equality means something very different in different communities. And how we talk about our successes and how we talk about different initiatives are going to be very important as we think about how we assign value to race and how we assign value to ethnicity in our work.
You know, in this moment where people are trying to figure out how best to show up, how best to make this not just a flash in the pan, but a real catalyst for lasting change, I know that my inbox is filled with people asking, what do we do? You know, what's the most strategic way to engage? White people who want to be allies, you know, asking, you know, how do we show up? For me, it is, what is your motivating self-interest? Because at the end of the day, I think that if people aren't motivated by something that is very personal, we will have a multiracial, equitable democracy, or we will have chaos. The only thing that is different right now is that the circumstances that have been a constant presence in Black neighborhoods are now visible to people who are shocked to see the militarization of police, the absolute disdain, the normalization of brutality. But these are not new things. The same mentality that allows us to cage children at the border is the same lack of concern for human life that allows a president to order the forcible removal of people in front of a church, a photo op. The photo op isn't just him in front of a church awkwardly holding the Bible. It is the show of force itself. So in this moment where we have an administration that is very willing, eager in fact, to use force, intimidate, attempt to strike fear with a community that is pouring into the streets even as we speak, where do we go from here? What happens next? How do people show up? How do the organizations that sign that letter move beyond the words on the page into action?
You know, I think it's important that we think about structural change, I know that we immediately go to representation. And representation is important. And it can move us forward, but when we mistake presence for power, that leads us to trouble. What we can't do is have a Black person or a trans person or a person with a disability or a woman or people with these intersecting identities in a position of leadership and thinking that that's going to be the answer. Having a liaison from a social identity is not going to be how we get to victory. And it only sets people up when these systems don't change. These hires can be a starting point, but we know that it has to be larger than that. We have to think about what is actually going to get us to structural change. We have to be thoughtful about how our systems are hurting people and who we're actually helping in the work that we're doing. And if we are disproportionately, that's a hint that something else is at play. There's something else we need to look at. If the criminalization of sex work is disproportionately locking up queer and trans people of color, then that's something that we need to examine. Or Black and brown communities are having negative health outcomes, and those are exacerbated by our LGBTQ identities, and that's something we have to examine. What we have to do is make commitment to ask these challenging questions, listen to the answers, believe the people that are saying them, and then be prepared to change. We have to know that sometimes we're going to be the first person, the first institution, the first organization to do something. So there might not be a precedent for it, but that doesn't mean that it's wrong. In fact, that actually might mean that it's right. For some people, not including a formal educational requirement on a job description would be unfathomable. But for some of us, we know that people with a lived experience are closer to the people we serve, and that's going to put our teams in a better place and better able to support folks. And really making sure that we're concentrating on the issue at hand, because a tactic that has always been used against our communities is to challenge how something is being done and ignore the actual problem that's happening.
Right.
These are things that we have to think about when we are when we want to create substantive change in our communities. It's not just putting a person in a position of power. That's not it at all. We have to actually change the culture, shift the paradigm there.
Michelle, you got animated there. What were you thinking about?
So, I mean, when Imani touched on the part of, you know, what is happening as a result of the actual foundational issue, you know, and we've seen it just now, you know, the Attorney General in the state of Florida is more concerned about property than actually being concerned about a Black man being killed. And so, for me, it's very nice that these organizations sign this letter. I think that it's wonderful. But my question becomes, what are your action items, right? How are you going to really begin to look internally? And I think Alfonso and Imani touched on it, really begin to look internally at the bias that you have, the, you know, maybe the underlying racism that you have, and really begin to interrogate that and really begin to do the work. Because I'm glad that you signed the letter, but then when I'm sitting in front of some of these folks that may have signed this letter, and you begin to then discount my experience as a Black woman, as a Black lesbian woman, when you begin to discount my experience about the way that you move in your organization, they move in the world, how it affects my people. And I mean, totally my people, Black folks, gay folks, people, my people, totally. Then to me, the letter means as much as the piece of paper or the email that it sent. So I think it's great. I think that's a step, but I feel like that should have happened. But what are your action items? What are the things that you're going to do to stand in solidarity with us? And not just solidarity in a letter, but are you going to be a comrade? Are you going to come out and put your body on the line? Are you going to put your money where your mouth is? Are you going to really stand with us in this moment? Because I don't need you to write a letter. I need you to put some action, to put some boots on the ground, however that may look.
So what does that look like, Alfonso?
There's so many different ways. We have so many different organizations and institutions, and how they function all differ. You have direct services organizations, advocacy organizations, political organizations. And what I would say is there are a number of different portals that leaders and executive directors should look at when they think about institutional systemic change. One, of course, is the work. Where are you placing your priorities? And how are those priorities affecting certain groups of people? And this also ties back to the initial point I was making. It's very difficult, just as human beings, for us to think about donating to an organization or an institution if we have no direct link. So I understand for some to say, well, why should we focus on that issue when the majority of our supporters don't reflect that demographic? The reason why that's important is because, again, if we don't focus on the marginalized, we will never achieve full equality. And if you need to think of that from a selfish perspective or self-interested perspective, fine. But I think from a moral perspective, it's important for us to really take a step back and invest in programs, approaches, initiatives that actually directly affect the marginalized. And so that would be the first thing I say that organizations should do. Second, I think just taking a step back and thinking about the institutional structure that exists and just simply evaluating whether or not that system needs to be revised, needs to be reviewed. Training is great, and people often talk about, well, we're going to do competency training. We will do diversity training. And I think that's great. But you have to look behind the curtain and really get a sense of whether or not you have institutional fractures within your organization or institution in order to solve those problems and actually create an environment where people can succeed. So I would say it's a little bit of both, really thinking about the programmatic work and the institutional administrative work and creating a path forward to change.
Now, one of the things when people are reaching out to me and asking what they can do in this moment, the thing about systems is they're intimidating. They have so many tentacles. They can cross you in so many different ways. But right now, with the attention that is focused on normalization of police brutality, I think the most important step that all of us collectively can take is to challenge systems within law enforcement, the mass incarceration, not just the killing of Black people, but that constant stop and frisk, humiliation, provocation. Because what's spilling out in the streets right now is George Floyd is a catalyst, but it is the boiling over of that constant nonstop flexing of power without consequence. And right now, what people are seeing is a level of accountability, a demand for accountability, a requirement that we're not going to look away. This isn't new. There are plenty of George Floyds who nobody had a camera rolling when he was murdered or she was murdered. We saw in this past week the extraordinary restraint of police officers when confronted by angry white mobs armed to the teeth, rattling the doors of state houses, jostling police, screaming in their faces in the midst of a pandemic. No arrests, even when there's videotape evidence, the question becomes, well, what happened right before the video started rolling? And then we go through the process of interrogating the victim rather than the perpetrator of the violence. And we're seeing that right now with Tony McCade's killing in Tallahassee. Here's the question. It boils down to one question and one question only. Did police act properly in attempt to apprehend a suspect? Or did police open fire because they didn't think Tony's life mattered? The police have lost the benefit of the doubt in those circumstances. We want the truth, whatever the truth is. But I notice that when police act properly, they're very quick to get those dash cams and those body cams out into the world. And right now, we're not seeing that evidence. We're hearing what the police say. We're hearing what people in the community are saying, and they don't add up. All that matters is what happened when police arrived. Did they responsibly attempt to arrest a suspect, or did they simply open fire on a transmasculine Black person because it doesn't matter? It doesn't matter what you do to us. It doesn't matter how you treat us. So to me, right now, it's not that law enforcement is the only pressure point, but it is a strategic pressure point. And I think we have to seize this moment that we're in, and all of us lean into a level of accountability throughout the entire judicial process, from what happens in the streets, accountability of police, into the prisons, into the borders. That is the place where we are seeing this very dangerous administration seek to expand their reach, seek to intimidate us out of protest. And I think that is an extraordinarily dangerous moment that we have to rise to. Andrea Jenkins, Council Member Andrea Jenkins has arrived. I'd like to invite her into. Thank you so much for joining us. I know that you are right at the epicenter of everything And we appreciate you making time to join this important conversation. We talked about intersectionality just a few minutes ago, and you literally sit at the intersection of this work as a city council member representing the district where George Floyd was murdered. Tell us what's going on. So thank you for being here.
Hey, Nadine. I live one block away from the site of the murder, but we've been working hard to maintain a sacred space, a safe place for people to come in and share their grief and mourn and just be with other people. We've all been sort of locked into our homes for the past 10 weeks. And so this human connection out there is really palpable. It's scary. I know we're going to have some testing and some medical support on the back end of this. But it really is a beautiful thing to see. People are literally protecting their homes in the middle of the night. So this community is exhausted. The level of Black women leadership has been through the roof. This district is represented by myself and also by the first Black person to serve on the Hennepin County board represents this area as well. So, you know, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, who has been steadfast in her support and leadership in this area. So it's an extraordinary show of support. But I want us to consider, last Monday, George Floyd was murdered. Next day, 4 officers were fired. 3 days later, the murderer was charged and arrested. He's still in jail. He has not been out on bail. He's still in custody. Then the Minnesota Department of Health files a discrimination suit against the Minneapolis Police Department, which really allows us now this opportunity to undo some of the structural beams that are holding up this racism in our society. We can instantly ban chokeholds. We can now say no chemical accelerant because we're leading up to this consent decree. It is a temporary sort of restraining order for the time being, but that is going to lead to some significant structural changes. And then just today, the other 3 officers involved in the murder of George Floyd have been arrested. And, you know, as President Obama talked about before this call, young people thought that about. But in this very same community that happened, you know, Ayanna was brutally beaten in this community by cis Black men. So our work, our struggle is real. It's very real. And being at these intersections, you know, and I'm sure all of you, this is one space where maybe this is a recognized reality. Some Black people do get a break from the hashtags, you know, but if it's not a Black woman murdered in her bed in Louisville, then it's a trans woman murdered on the streets of Dallas. And I know that all of you on this call do that too, because y'all all are down with the trans struggle, right? We're a community in pain, but I think we should be really recognizing the victories. As all of you are organizers, you got to stop and understand the power of the work that you are doing. And I hope that's happening. And I'm trying to create a narrative and a space for people to recognize that. You know, it is not the end. But in order to keep fighting, I think you have to understand, you know, the gains that you're making.
Well, Andrea, thank you so much for that. And I think right now what we are seeing so very clearly is that in this moment, pushing back against the normalization of police brutality and the systemic racism within law enforcement, within the criminal justice system, are places where we can collectively lean in and make a difference. It, without a doubt, there would be no arrests in the murder of George Floyd had it not been for the outpouring.
When I saw that video, I'm like, these people, and the mayor too, I gotta say, we push from the community is no doubt. None of these changes would be there without that activism. There's no question.
So we've got to seize that. But you also hit on something that I do want the panel to talk to, which is this. For example, Michelle, you were at the forefront of the McBrockton case. You got the justice for that family that Trayvon Martin's family did not get. When I look at who showed up for the that Stand Your Ground killing of a black man, and I look at who showed up for the multiple murders of black trans women in Florida, there was very little overlap. How do we call, just as we have collectively called on the broader LGBTQ movement to show up around protecting black lives, pushing back in these ways, we also are calling on the black community to show up and be as outraged when black trans women are murdered, when black trans men are murdered, when we are targeted. I have been a victim of police brutality. And it was in a circumstance where the police officer, because of my race, because I was a lesbian, and because I run the organization that I run, and I was speaking up on behalf of the transgender city manager that was being fired. He was seething. And, you know, it. I was in a position where people rallied around me, people supported me, people spoke out, and charges were dropped, apologies were issued. But the trauma of being brutalized by police officers literally kneeling on my, on me where I am saying I cannot breathe, and their response is if you can talk, you can breathe. So you can imagine for me these circumstances from Eric Garner to this one bring that trauma very much to the surface. But what I want to say is, how do we convey to people, to the black community, you've got to understand that attacks on the trans community attacks on LGBTQ people, you've got to stand in solidarity. And similarly, as we have said to the LGBTQ community, attacks on black people are attacks on the LGBT community. Christian Cooper, bird watching in Central Park, you know, what's so chilling about that was not just that a white woman responded aggressively to him for asking her to leash her dog, but that she understood precisely how to weaponize her whiteness and blackness, that she knew to perform as though she were terrified to maximize the danger to him. There's something so insidious in that, mm-hmm. that it's so necessary to call out. How do we speak to both of the places where we live? So as Alfonso says, you ask me who I am, I'm a black lesbian. You don't even have to put a space between them. That is my identity, and I get to move right through the world as that. So how do we bridge those worlds?
You know, I think for me, one of the ways that I bridge it in the work that I do and the rooms that I'm in, I name it. I name it very clearly. I call it out. I call it forth. You know, I did a CNN article where I talked about queer folks and trans folks have been in this work. And I think that one of the things is that you have to name it. You have to speak it. When we're at strategy tables, it's one thing to say, okay, well, Black Lives Matter, and you start talking about, you know, of course, when there's black men for the hierarchy of black men, then black women, and then, oh, well, I guess y'all. No. You name it. So that's one of the things that I have found just when I'm in these rooms, especially with, you know, cisgender, heterosexual black men, we're not going to have a conversation about, you know, civil rights. We're not going to have a conversation about movement work, and we're not including, you know, my trans sisters. We're not including LGBTQ, but we're not going to have a conversation. And so one of the ways that I have found to be effective is that I challenge the folks who are at the table with me, right? And if I can start challenging the leaders who are at the table with me, then folks who are just every day like, hey, I don't really know too much about what this means. But people like my mom's age, my mom's 75 years old. And then you start engaging in conversations with her. Oh, well, I heard such and such say on TV about this. Well, Michelle, what do you know about that? But if we, as people who are, you know, I guess, quote unquote leaders, are leading this movement and wherever we find ourselves are not challenging the other co-leaders, and we're not having them speak truth to power, the way, kind of the way I move through it. But I name it. And I'll call it out and I'll say, this is what you are. And if you don't agree with it, that's fine. But you can't tell me about my experience. So, you know, I get a little hyper. But still, but that's how it is.
Imani?
Yeah, I want to add to that. You know, that is also a tactic. When I walk in as a queer person, I didn't stop being Black when that happened. And so the idea that is going to separate me, that's a tactic to pit us against one another. And we know that that happens in the reverse.
Right.
It's also a pretty common misconception that racism doesn't exist in the LGBTQ movement. And we know that that's not true. That LGBTQ folks experience discrimination based on sexual orientation, but also we experience racism and sexism and transphobia and discrimination based on all parts of our identity. And that's even within the LGBTQ community. It's dangerous because when people believe that we're not experiencing discrimination, or that you can't be part of perpetuating discrimination, or actively participating in oppressing other groups, then that's just not true. We know that someone can vote for Obama, lead in progressive politics, and then harass a Black gay man. Racism is insidious. And the unfortunate truth is that when we're not actively working to be anti-racist, then our movement will be inherently racist, because that's just how we work. A movement will not and cannot support Black LGBTQ folks and LGBTQ people of color without looking at racial justice. And that's why people talk about the importance of being intersectional in our work. We can't get to LGBTQ equality if Black LGBTQ folks can't bird watch or go for a jog or sleep in their own house without being subjected to racial harassment or being killed by police. Black and brown trans women are disproportionately harassed and killed because of the combination of their race and gender identities, and these murders go unsolved. And we know that that's something that we have to pay attention to. And then acting like we can also celebrate pride and have a worthwhile LGBTQ movement without looking at racial justice, that's ignoring the experience of Black LGBTQ people and LGBTQ people of color. And so that's why our LGBTQ movement, it has to be a racial justice movement, it has to be a gender justice movement, and an economic justice movement. We have to take everyone with us. And because we're running out of time, I do just want to say, too, we need to pay attention in this moment, what is happening next? Because we've been here before. And we know that this is when focus groups start to happen, community forums start to happen, listening sessions start to happen, people are put in roles where they're a liaison to the community, and then nothing ever changes. We have to make sure that we are looking at, there's a difference between having individual comfort, there's a difference between one person having a positive experience with a police officer, and actual institutional structural change. And I want to make sure that we are paying attention to that when this happens, because there are going to be people on cameras that saying, this is a great experience I'm having with this person. And that's wonderful. We need to look at, are we seeing these murders going down? Are we seeing the people that are institutionalized, people that are in prisons? Are we seeing those numbers going up or going down? Because if they're going up or they're staying the same, then nothing's changed. And we want to make sure that in this moment that we are looking at what happened, because we don't want to get bamboozled. We've been here before. So we're in an amazing spot. Folks are in the street, and nothing in this country has happened without people being in the streets. People have been in the streets, and that's how things end up in the courts. It doesn't go the other way around. And so when people try to use that tactic to say, oh, we should be doing something else, we want to remember that that's never gotten us anywhere, that this is the way to our victory. This has been the way to our equality. So to really pay attention to what happens right now.
In addition to what Michelle and Imani said, because I think this is really important, and Andrea sort of alluded to this as well. As we are going through this process and we think about building these bridges, we have to think about how we can use our history to create our future. I can tell you that, unfortunately, we need more people to understand that the LGBTQ civil rights movement was started by transgender women of color. And understand that we are in a position of power and access because of those women. They had the courage to fight, and very few people did. And we need to understand that history and respect it in order to create a path forward to a future. Second, as we think about coalition building, many of us create coalitions outside of the LGBTQ community. When we create these coalitions, we have to show up intentionally prioritizing issues that affect marginalized communities within our community. And that means the transgender community. And if we have people doing that, we create a path for change. And then finally, we should talk about the numbers. Since the Human Rights Campaign has been tracking violent deaths of transgender people, 172 people have been killed since 2013. 73% were Black. 73% were Black. So going back to your initial point, Nadine, as we think about protests and as we think about change, we need to make sure that conversation is inclusive and we use our history to really create a path to our future.
I'm so glad you said that. I was about to do two things. One, Edmund White has his recollections of being at Stonewall. One of the things he says, whereas gays had always run away in the past, afraid of being arrested and jailed, these Stonewall African-Americans and Puerto Ricans and drag queens weren't so easily intimidated. They lit fires, turned over cars, and mocked the police, even battering the heavy Stonewall doors where some policemen were retaining members of the staff and customers, waiting for the paddy wagons to return. I wanted to read that, and I also want to lift up the names of Patrice Concolors, Opal Tometi, and Garza as those who gave birth to the Black Lives Matter movement as an intentionally inclusive space, as a space that rejected the sexism and the heterosexism of too many Black institutions and leaders. And we are benefiting from that leadership. And it hurts the work of dismantling racism to push the Bayard Rustin voices to the back, to undercut the leadership that LGBTQ people bring into that space. And similarly, I say to white colleagues in this work around intersectionality, you understand intersectionality because you understood it around HIV and AIDS. It wasn't something that was unique to our community, but we understood that we had to rally around it because it was disproportionately affecting us. And the remedy was hampered by stigma toward us. And by those criteria, we must show up as a community around the violence that is being done to Black people, the violence that is being done to transgender people. And we have to show up not as an ancillary or a side issue that we might get to, but at the core of it. What difference does it make if you have public accommodation protections, if moving those public accommodations can cost you your life? You know, what value are these rights if you don't have the freedoms to exercise those rights? So I do want to lift up those voices as we near the end of our broadcast. Parting thoughts from everyone?
I think we are at a moment of opportunity, and certainly for multiple directions. So we have a responsibility, I think, to make this an opportunity to reshape America and have Black and brown, trans, queer, disabled immigrants at the center, and we can do it.
Thank you. Michelle?
We must love each other. We must support each other. We have nothing to lose but our chains. And that is Queen Asada. And I want us to know that in this space of being Black, being LGBTQ plus, and also for our folks who are in the LGBTQ family who are not Black, it is still your duty to help us win. It is still your duty to love us. Because if we aren't free, y'all aren't free either.
Imani?
So my sister came up with this metaphor that I just love. So my real estate, I'm changing a little bit. But imagine you're in this basement with other people. The basement's crowded and there are a bunch of people that want to be left out and the door's locked. And it's a basement, so it's full of other things too, like bookshelves and boxes and old things that might hurt you. And at the door, the people that are in the inside, they're banging on the door and they're screaming, oh, there it is, in this basement, and they want to be let let out of this basement. In the back of the basement, there are people that would like to be let out too, but they're behind boxes or they've tripped over a bookshelf. So now they can't actually get out of the door. So even if the door were unlocked, they couldn't actually get past these things to get out of the basement. And I think that's actually a really good metaphor for our movement a lot of times, because the people that are at front, the people that are the most privileged, then just a little bit of support would help. With the folks in the back, there need to be other support. And that's how we have to look at our LGBT movement. How we get every LGBTQ person to a place where the door can get open. And so everyone can benefit from that. And so that's why we have to be really thoughtful about being a racially just movement. Like, we have to be really thoughtful about how are we making this accessible to everyone so that we can actually get to LGBTQ equality. And so it's saying the same thing. Like, we're all better when we're all better. That matters that some of us have different identities, but we have things in common, that we're sharing things, that we're talking about what it looks like to be a Black person that's also experiencing that also has other identities.
Thank you, Moni. Alfonso, your parting thoughts?
We all have one thing in common. We're all human. And we're all fighting for equality. In order for us to get to equality, we need change. So peaceful protesting is great, but we need people to vote. Peaceful protesting plus voting equals change. Peaceful protesting plus voting equals change.
And just some parting thoughts. This is a pivotal moment for our country. It is important that we vote. It is important that we put our bodies out there, that the outrage that we feel is heard. And I want to encourage people at this moment, you have the power to contact local law enforcement and ask them what they are doing to make sure what happened to George Floyd never happens, to talk to them about the accountability structure within law enforcement. In Fort Lauderdale, the police officer who, in front of other officers with cameras rolling, slammed a woman to the ground who was on her knees with her hands up. He did it because it had been normalized to him. And what was different on this day is he got called out by other police officers. So this is an important moment and we can't squander it. It requires us to do all of the things, to have those conversations in the spaces where if you don't have them, they will not happen. It means engaging our families, our neighbors, our classmates, and being unafraid to call white supremacy what it is, to be unafraid of naming the fear that demographic change has brought, and to know in our bones that the path forward is a multiracial, equitable society where there is a place for everyone, not the political apartheid caused by voter suppression, mass incarceration, and disempowering people. That path leads to chaos. That path will take this entire country down. We will have an equitable, multiracial future, or we will not exist. And so I thank everybody for joining this conversation. I hope that it is the beginning of many conversations. All of our rights are inextricably linked. You cannot fight for partial justice. You have to fight for full justice.